I am so excited tonight to welcome Karen Adah, who is a friend of mine, in addition to being a great speaker. She's also a meditation instructor, an ordained Buddhist, a world traveler, and an author. And that's why we're here tonight, to hear a reading from her book and also to potentially purchase a copy. Karen Adah kept a journal during her silent, solitary retreat in the New Zealand wilderness. And this was a journal of her inner reflections when she dealt with numerous hardships and in the end discovered a blossoming of deep open-heartedness. I'm really excited to hear about that tonight. What you may not know about Karen Adah is that she's an award-winning international artist, researcher, and she lived in Kyoto, Japan for over 18 years, where she taught at, I'm going to mispronounce this, Doshisha and Kyoto Sangyo Universities. She later taught at Mass College of Art and Design, and she is a very fabulous artist who also creates artwork on her retreat. So I imagine she'll talk about that as well. The last bit of exciting news is that she's about to embark on a 3-year solitary retreat. So she'll also talk about what is going through her head now, just before she leaves, right? Can you all join me in welcoming Karen Adah?
Well, this could be the largest group I've spoken to. Are you hearing me okay?
Yeah.
Excellent. Very good. Very good. Wow. I was saying the last talk that I gave was two months ago down in San Miguel de Allende in Mexico at the Biblioteca, and we had easily 50 people squished in there, and I wished I had a mic there because I really had to project. They said, we could hear you, and I said, oh, felt like I was going to lose my voice by the end of it, but I did it. So I love libraries. I am at the Kingston Library, which is the town I'm from, almost every day. I was there yesterday, today twice, and tomorrow as well. I do a little bit of meditation teaching there, and we sit two groups a week there as well. So I'm delighted to be up here in Portsmouth, the big city. And talking to a slightly larger group, only about 20 more than what I've done before. But Chandra Das and I were talking about why there's so many people here. I said, I think this is because it's weird. You don't walk down the street very often and find people that have decided to take a vow of silence for a year. And then the great surprise is that I actually decided 2 months ago to do it for 3 years instead of just one. So, and I'm off in a month. So you name it, what I'm trying to do. So people say, you look exhausted. I said, I am exhausted. You know, 148 things, but I'm getting through them all to be able to get out of the house and out of the community and into silence. I'll talk to you more about that. But the nice thing about this is I've been ordained, I think, exactly 10 years today. It's my birthday. And I was ordained in Spain. And even before that, I was doing solitary retreats, but they were all shorties, you know, between 2 weeks up to about a month until finally, I think it was 2014, I said, I want to do a year. And so where on earth would I do this? And I ended up in New Zealand, and that's as far from Boston, that's the accent you're hearing, far from Boston as you possibly could get, other side of the world, southern hemisphere. There was only one tree that was familiar to me, and that was a pine tree, and I'd go and hug it occasionally and smell the sap, and it would smell like New Hampshire, and I'd be okay. So what I wanted to do was share some of this book with you and answer your questions, too. And I'll, if it's okay with you, intersperse a little bit of my reading with some of your questions rather than hold them all to the end. Is that way so we can interact a little bit more? My daughter is here. She knows how to manage the book sales. So Amanda is, and she manages so many things for my life in order to make it possible for me to travel like this. So blessings on her and her partner, Kevin, with there, and her mom and dad in the back. Some of you know me, a few of you, and some of you know the story. Some of you already have the book and have read it, but you came here anyways. And some of you have no idea who the heck I am. So I thought to lay this out a little bit, I would just look at this introduction that I created. This book really is a year of silence. When I was departing, I told many people that I was doing this for others, not for me. and that I wanted to carry them with me. How could I share that experience with others? One person told me that she was going to follow my blog. And I said, no electricity, no blog, no internet, and no telephone line. And she went, oh, I thought, they said, will you write? I said, well, I have been journaling since 1998, so I do write. She goes, well, maybe you'd share that with us. So what this actually is my journal almost every day. You can look up your birthday and see what I was doing, what the weather was like. A lot of people doing that. Somebody up at Arialoka this weekend actually read from that day in New Zealand, you know, and it was appropriate for what we were doing that day. So anyways, it has my practice. It has quite a few observations of what I was experiencing there. I love nature. I live in a rural house that my dad built when I was a child, and it has recipes in it, mainly because one of my favorite people who was a solitary was at 13,000 feet for 12 years, and she was always making sourdough bread in a pressure cooker. And so there I was in New Zealand. I thought, I wish she'd included that recipe, you know? Sourdough bread in a pressure cooker. So there's about 6 recipes in here as well that might be good, and a few photographs. So just to kick it off, I'll see if I can go through this introduction and that you would understand what it is. I fly out of a New England summer of lake swimming, watermelon, tomatoes, and fields of corn across the United States through San Francisco, where I board a second plane that will take me around the world to Auckland, New Zealand, 13,000 feet, 14 hours away in the Southern Hemisphere. It's a long, long flight over the Pacific. Yet it feels quite familiar, for I lived in Japan for 18 years and made yearly travels back home. It was in Japan that I found Buddhism, seeing a monk walking the back streets of Kyoto with such a glowing face that I wanted to know what he knew and how it could make him so happy. It was there that I started the daily meditation practice that has been a part of my life for 35 years. Japan was also a time of raising children, ending relationships, pursuing my art, multiple exhibitions, producing a book on the Japanese wax resist technique that I still practice. My Soto Zen studies were important too, but with my limited language facility, it was difficult to move further. And the idea of Buddhist ordination as a Western woman in Japan at that time seemed unattainable. Upon return to the United States, I found Triratna, a Western Buddhist order, where I could study the Dharma in English, have the support of a vibrant community, and undergo the training I needed for the next step. In June of 2009, I received ordination in the mountains of Spain with an international group of 17 women. I became Kiranada. Now I'm on an airplane at 36,000 feet, flying across the Pacific to a year of silence in the New Zealand bush, while others snooze all around me. I look at what brought me here, to this time in my life, and many things come up. I've always been a searcher with an adventurous spirit, curious about nature, about people and their stories, about my own internal story and what motivates me. After multiple short solitaries of 2 to 4 weeks in length, the idea of a full year of solitary retreat intrigued me. But why now? A little over 2 years ago, I returned from a winter in Mexico with overwhelming responsibilities, preparation for a large solo exhibition, a new commission request, a car that was breaking down, still is, and a computer that had stopped dead. It was the computer and the car that did me in and had me thinking that it was time to reassess this busy lifestyle and go. I just come from a month's solitary retreat in Mexico. It had been disturbing, but held much promise of future illumination. I sat down, looked at my life, and saw a new decade beginning in just 2 years. I knew that it would take me that long with careful planning to make it happen. Checking with family and colleagues, I made a plan to be off by July of 2014 for that long retreat, to focus on my meditation practice, watch the birds, deal with any demons that came up, and be silent for a year. What would come of it? Work colleagues wondered if I might never come back. Family and friends worried if I would be safe. What I wanted was time for something that had been intriguing me since I was a child. It's 5:20 a.m. when the plane lands on a bright July day. It's deep winter, I'm told, but a mild rainy one rather than the snowy chill of my home. In Auckland, I spend 2 nights in a women's Buddhist community, getting over jet lag, gathering supplies, seeing an old friend before I disappear for a year. The drive out of the city takes me through suburbs and a landscape of flat farmland. In an hour, I enter the Coromandel Peninsula. Its jagged peaks form a backdrop to the small town of Thames, formerly a gold mining village. Now sleepy and quiet. At first, the road hugs the Firth of Thames, but soon we turn off eastwards and up for 20 minutes between steep, overlapping spurs covered in craggy, deep green, overlooking the dark valley that I will call home for a year. We're unable to cross the river onto the Sudarshanaloka Buddhist Retreat Center's land because of a swift current from heavy rain. It's a typical occurrence here, I'm told, but a four-wheel drive vehicle is there to pick me up with my supplies, and we drive across and up along a rugged gravel road for 20 minutes to the small hut in the bush that I will use as a hermitage. I feel like Alice slipping through the looking glass. Again, I'm reminded by a local supporter, it's for a year, and alone. Who will I be when I come out? Will there be insights? Will there be troubles? I have no idea how hard it will be, but I'm ready. I've asked for this solitary confinement at Abaya Hut, Abaya, whose name means fearlessness. I put my right hand up, palms facing forward, fingers rising to the sky in the mudra of fearlessness. This is Abaya. And step off that transport to walk that last quarter mile in. I step into darkness, overwhelming growth, tree ferns, perching lilies dangling above, kauri, rata, and puriri trees, and dangling tangles of supplejack. This is a land I am so unfamiliar with. I walk into the dark of the bush, and then around a corner, and a small green hut appears, perched on a precipice, open to the grand valley below, sitting in the sun, home. I'm committed. I've been drawn since childhood to do this year alone, eager, curious to learn what might be presented to me. I'm looking for answers to the simple questions. What would happen if I sat in the high bush by myself for 12 months without the support of everyday distractions? Other more profound questions come up. Would I survive? Would I go mad? Would I continue to create? Would I discover new things? Who would be my teachers? Would my Buddhist studies and meditation support and ground me? Would my solitude allow me to find what that Japanese monk with the glow knew? I'm guided by words from my elders and carry these words with me into silence. Quote, from Henry David Thoreau, I went to the woods to live deliberately. And from Kobun Chino Roshi, when you realize how rare and how precious your life is, and how completely you are responsible for how you live it, how you manifest it, it's such a big responsibility that naturally such a person sits down for a while. That's the intro. That was written after the fact. Everything else was written actually right on site during the time that I was there. I had a wonderful editor who picked this book up, I guess, 6 months after I had transcribed it from the written notebooks, and read it through and said, you know, Kiranada, there's possibilities for this beyond just your family and your Buddhist friends. If you'd go through it and do some rewrites, explain some of your Buddhist terms. And she said, I think that it has a wider group that would be interested. So that I spent almost 18 months putting that together to do it. And likewise, I went ahead and self-published it, which was a smart thing because so many books, it takes between 6 months to 17 months to get it published after it is polished and finished, I've been told. And so it might still not have come out yet. And guess what? I'm leaving again. So. Do you have a quick question from someone? Some burning thing? Yes.
Can you just share with us your thoughts about the need for the human spirit to want to talk, to want to communicate? And what were you thinking about as you endeavored on this? And after 12 months, did you walk away with any thoughts about how we can live our lives better without a year of silence, but maybe a lot more silence than we currently have?
Well, that's what this whole hour is going to be. Let me know at the end if you learned anything for sure about it, because that's very much how I hope to share. Yes, we are talking beings for sure, but if there's no one there to talk to, you don't talk. You know, if you don't have companions, it's many people do silent retreats, even with groups of people, but they keep silence. When you do that, you throw yourself back inward. You become much more aware of what's around you, aware of your inner workings. I know when I was on my ordination retreat, they said, and all of you are going to start writing poetry, so just curb it, you know, we'll just have one wall where you're putting up all your poems. Suddenly everyone was silent and they're doing poetry. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. It just, the inside parts just kind of bubble out in some way. We do interact with each other. That's part of being human in many ways. And yet the chance to pull that plug is extraordinarily beneficial. Extraordinary. It's luscious to be able to stop and to listen for a change and listen to the silence. I'm a good gregarious talker, as you might have guessed, and yet I love it. I love it. So a number of us that are sitting here have been sitting in silent meditation for hours, for years, 35, almost 38 years I've been doing it daily. And on this solitary retreat, I did 6 to 8 hours of meditation a day and other things. So, yeah. Some of what came up, I'm going to mention. And one of the things was fairly early on, the first month or two, my life showed up. It's surprising. You know, they say when you die, you might have your life flash across in front of you. Well, mine spent 3 months going across in front of me. Remembering all the things that I may have said that I was embarrassed about, or things that other people said, and things that happened to me in my life, and etc. For the first time in, I guess, my life, I could just stop and sit and take a thought and follow it all the way through, even if it took 2 days, and write about it. It was wonderful. And not be interrupted by a phone call, by a dinner date, by someplace you had to go. Really yummy. One of the things that came up had to do with forgiveness. A lot of forgiveness. Those first 3 months were really forgiving myself, forgiving others, so that then I could actually stop and be present and be there. And so I wrote a little bit about that and thought I would share that with you about forgiveness. I've had a strange life. Okay. Today, however, I'm awake to something that keeps coming up and needs resolution. It's surprising what shows its head after lurking under the surface for years. I realized this morning that it's time to forgive a number of people, to put down my anger at losing things to those that hold what once was mine, things that were taken, not given. Am I the only one that ever had somebody walk out of the house with their stuff? Our second precept in the positive version speaks of giving with an open-handed generosity as opposed to taking what is not given. It's a more positive way of looking at what we could call stealing. We may steal many things from others in our lives, including goods, time, attention. This precept makes us aware of the need to work on this. I've done my share of taking the not given. Today I need to set aside my feelings and reactions and do a ritual to give away all those things that were once mine but walked out of my house in the arms of another person. It's time. So, I can't remember one thing being taken from my house in Japan over 18 years, even with more than 13 different people subletting my house during that time. That's amazing. Not one. Bless them for not coveting what they saw. Perhaps they were less greedy, and I never harbored anger for the camera, shoes, and clothes that were taken from my backpack in Thailand, or the break-in during my first day in Bali. I expected that any money from those thefts went to buy rice for families that really needed it. My heart is light concerning those incidents. But during 5 years in the military, I really come from the Vietnam era, with household moves from Massachusetts, Florida, Iceland, and Arizona. Others were hired to do the packing and shipping, and a number of pieces of furniture walked away, as well as some clothing. Did someone need these things or only covet them? And as I was packing up my own goods in Arizona, my grandmother's Victorian mirror with candle scones disappeared from the back of the moving van packed in our carport between midnight and the next morning. Furniture, clothing left my house in New Hampshire while remodeling work was being done and I was in Japan. I'm getting this all down so I can really be done with it at last. And personal wax tools and videos from classrooms as well as some art have all walked away. The anger has certainly dissipated over the years, but some sense of violation or injustice still lingers. I need to transform those incidences and be done with them, too. I've decided that today it will be over. I said to myself out loud, "Those things are yours now. Today I am giving them to you, those things that you took. Those things were never mine, really. I was only a caretaker. So, from today, please consider all those things as gifts from me. May they make you happy and well. May you enjoy their use. Truly, from my heart, I send this wish. May they make your life more beautiful. They were things that pleased me, that my family enjoyed for 80 years in some cases, and now they are yours. I set aside my feelings of anger and violation. I give up any ownership. With a candle, incense, and a bow, they are yours." Being able to do something like that makes a world of difference, to really finally let go of that stuff. So some of you think that I was there alone on that precipice. Oh, everybody wants to know about food. How did you eat? I know that was the next question somebody was coming. Right. I try to have solitary retreats at places where I am supported. In other words, there is a community or group that is willing to kind of look after those people that are in the huts. And Sudarshanaloka is one of our Triratna places. There are five huts on the 250 acres. And once a week, we leave a note in a box in the bush. And the guys come up on the off-road vehicle and get the note. And the next morning, do the shopping. And if we're lucky, down in Thames, a box of food appears in the box the next day. And I backpack it up to my hut without ever seeing anybody. So it worked so beautifully. Occasionally, the first month, there were three rotten eggs. And certainly the grapefruit had holes in it. It was mushy. Yeah. You know, it was a little bit difficult to make a food list when you're not in the grocery store. You know, what is it that I want? What do I need? I kept limiting it to just 16 or 17 items at the most. And I was on a tight budget because of my own foolishness, because I insisted that I could eat on $300 a month. because I ate on $300 a month in Japan and I do in New Hampshire, but they told me $400 was good for New Zealand and I couldn't believe them. So it was true. So I was $67 a week was all that I could spend. So, and, but it worked beautifully. And I ended up eating only two meals a day, which was just fine, so that I didn't spend all my time preparing the next meal or thinking, sitting on my cushion, thinking about the next meal. So letting go of that. It's beautiful. I still do this now. I think I just had two meals today, as a matter of fact. But besides being alone there in the bush and not seeing anybody, nothing, from here all the way across to here, just this giant valley, I could hear the rushing water and a wall of green on the far side. Occasionally, some cattle would show up, and I'd get so excited. I'd get my binoculars and try to decide if they were dairy cows or beef cows, or really, it was very exciting when something showed up in the green. Basically, it was kind of me and the birds. But so I told somebody that actually I fell in love, which just kind of happens, you know. There I was, and so I fell in love. With a leaf. A second new awakening. I don't remember what the first awakening was, but the second new awakening was today. I fell in love. I've been more conscientious about doing my second meditation session as a one-hour outdoor walking meditation, weather permitting. Sometimes the first pass down the walk is clearing the path from things that blew it down through the night in the nighttime storms, but usually it's quite pleasant. I walk slowly and mindfully with eyes cast down as I have been taught. I don't take this as a morning nature walk or as exercise, but as a meditation practice. In the Theravadin sect, it is a strong part of practice, perhaps equal in time to that on the cushion. And for some monks, it's their major practice. At the end of my 35 paces this morning, as I made my turn, I saw an oval leaf shining green, serrated on one side with some insect holes scattered on the opposite side. With every pass, I saw it there, at first highlighted in sunlight and later in shade. Each time, it became more interesting. Oh, those insect bites and that lovely shape. I passed by it 30 or 40 times in that hour. It reminded me of the saying that whatever you focus on, you'll fall in love with. That leaf became a practice in mindfulness, awareness, and focus. I look forward to seeing it tomorrow morning and trust it will still be there, sunning itself inconspicuously at the end of my path. Nobody else would be grabbed by its beauty, but with my withdrawal from all stimulation and with my silence and deep focus, I've fallen in love. I'm fortunate to have an opportunity to really see. Mae Sarton, that poet of New England, writes of this too, saying, she cites Simone Weil, absolute attention is prayer. She uses this phrase often when teaching and suggests that if one looks long enough at almost anything, looks with absolute attention at a flower, a stone, the bark of a tree, grass, snow, a cloud, something of a revelation takes place. We cease to be aware of ourselves, losing self in admiration and joy. It's amazing those kind of things have a chance to manifest and for you to take them in and absolutely see. It's not the life we live here, so busy with traffic and demands and our screens, for sure. Question? Yes.
During your silence, did you sing to yourself at all?
I chant, and that's singing, yes. It's ironic. You know, I have prayers that I do and pujas and chanting to do, and yet it wasn't very long before I stopped vocalizing that. I started speaking like this to myself. I stopped projecting, mainly because it was breaking the space. So I whispered it. I whispered these things to myself. And yes, I sang to myself, but in a whisper. It was quite amazing. I will tell you one time I came around the hut, and there on that little bit of lawn were all these six, what looked like bunny rabbits, and they were gray quail. And I went, oh my gosh. And then I went, oh, I spoke. I heard my voice. It's funny. Yes, another question. Yes.
I want to know, when you make art, does that bring you to a similar place?
Yes, I would say so. That's something that I've been looking at for many, many years. We look at dhyanas, and I think when doing art, we drop into the first and second dhyana easily, dropping no self and all. Nobody there. If you can do your art without assessment, without judging and all of that. I realized I put in a few things here, which you might get a kick out of seeing. It's only recent that I've done any talks that were not in the dark. I'm an artist, and so, you know, art history classes are always done in the dark, and there's always a visual up here. So the whole idea of people actually looking at me while I was talking was so hard for me to do. So I print them out. Anyways, I did a number of pieces while I was there in New Zealand. I'll hold some of them up. This was a two-part piece that really, when I started the piece, I realized it was an absolute calendar of 2 6-month sessions with each month there and 4 weeks and all. And if you look at it, I mean, I, you know, put in the frost that was coming and when the flowers were blooming, and I quilted and stitched on that. It was fun. I did mantras all over a chair. It's still there. Om Mani Padme Hum, all over this chair. And there I am stitching on this piece of Ahimsa non-harm silk that's there. I usually do wax resist, which you might know as batik, but I also teach at Mass Arts this shibori technique, which is a running stitch and then pulling up the threads and coming up with patterns like this. So I did a series of about 6 or 7 pieces that are done with natural dyes. Ironically, the front of the book has one of them on it. Damarati wanted to do a book cover. He said, where's your work? So this is some of my work on the front of it, too. But I wanted to share with you, my son says that the best piece of artwork I have ever done is this one, which is from fruit stickers that I collected over an entire year. Every single sticker from the fruit, I held on to them. And in the last 3 weeks, I was there and decided I'd make a piece of artwork from it. So there is Buddha surrounded by fruit stickers, and you can see whether it was kiwi or whether it was peaches. Oh, and I didn't bring it home. You know, it's down in the hut down there. Anyways, it was kind of fun. So I did a bit of artwork. I had 12-volt electricity, which is about what you have on a boat. So I had one light bulb, and so I tended to not use it. When it got dark, I went to bed, and when the sun came up, I got up. So I slept longer in the wintertime, like the bears, and I was awake more in the summertime. I couldn't plug in anything, really. I had a little gas stove with 2 burners. A sweet friend gave me a box, an aluminum box to put onto the stove, a camping oven, and so I made scones every week, which was great fun. So. And the water was collected in cistern. It came off the roof and was purified, and that's what I drank. And the outhouse was out across. It was outdoors. A rat got stuck in the outhouse and was running around to begin with. And there were possums on the roof in the night. That was the fun part. So, some of you do meditation, and I thought I would just share a little bit about my experience there. Things that come up when you're sitting there for so long. So I have a group in Kingston that kind of depends on me to spur them on. So I even wrote this down and mailed it and sent it back to the meditation group to sit there and look at it. So it says here, how can I write this down? While I'm meditating on my cushion in front of my shrine, it's as if I'm transformed into a busy train station. Most of us drive cars here, but some of us know trains and know subways, so try to think of this. As I follow my breath in and out, a thought may arrive, like a train pulling into that station. At that moment, I have a choice. I can board that train and depart with that thought as it travels through multiple stations and end up, 30 minutes later, far from my intended concentration focus. Or I can continue sitting and just watch. I noticed this morning that there really could be a gap, a conscious decision to board that train or to let it pass through, to put energy and content into that thought or not. The image reminds me of the great benefits I've received from suffering from a concussion. You don't need to hear about that. I did go into that with having suffered a concussion and managed to, during my time on solitary, have it completely clear. It actually took me 2 years to recover from that one. So what do I do when I come back here, 2016, and I have a second concussion? That just cleared in January completely, which is kind of why I'm able to make plans, because I don't have daily headaches and et cetera. So, yeah. Considering this book and what I wrote here, it really is like this reference that I made to this jewel, prepping it. From my musings yesterday on doing this retreat for others, for all sentient beings, I concluded that I should indeed polish and clean this jewel of practice as I would a gift. My mind's eye envisioned a wonderful orb, my actions held in my hand, cleaned, buffed, and polished to a glow. It came to me that I could do this by carrying clear, clean intentions to every prayer, every recitation, every mantra that I do, as though I was preparing to hand them to someone as a present. I quietly watched my recitations of the refuges and the 10 precepts, and rather than just singing them out by rote and memory, I stopped after each one, letting the intention and the sound echo in my being. I visualized the 108 mantras as an exquisite string of beads, preparing each mantra as a jewel for others. I polished the loving kindness prayer, heard the words, watched my articulation, my enunciation, and made it as purposeful and beautiful as it truly is. This whole life here and all that I'm learning is a jewel to be given away to others. But the start is the waking up, polishing that orb, letting it shine and gleam in my hands and offering it up. And I often just say that that's what this book is. I prepared it not for me, not for any benefit of me at all, but just as a gift to other people.
I know very little about Buddhism, but this concept of solitary intrigues me. You know, our time together is so precious and limited. And the idea of disengaging from my family for a year blows my mind. I mean, I just don't know that I could do that. So I guess my question is, what revelations, what epiphanies did you have as a result of this year that then influenced your relationship with your family, with those around you? This book is a wonderful gift, but in your interactions, how are you different?
She was asking about what benefit other people, what a benefit the family might have from me being away for a year. What do I have to give back to them? Am I any different? Well, I hope I'm different. I guess we have to ask other people that, how am I different? I talk to many people about this because it's hard for people to walk, to follow their bliss, to follow what is their life. We have limited time, you say, and yet I'm counting on 100 years myself. So that's 25 more, knock on wood. So in all of that time, I should think we could come up with a year or two of being quiet and being introspective. I find that there's tremendous benefit coming from it. I'm a very, very lucky person to have the opportunity to do this, and it has to do with the family that I was birthed into and that kind of just put me on the tricycle and said, go, we're okay. And so I've been pedaling ever since. And hopefully I bring back something. I get Mother's Day cards that say, terrific mom. So we'll see. Yes, question.
When it was happening, did you feel guilty? Were you distracted by thoughts like, maybe my loved ones need me urgently right now, and they wish I was there to talk to, but I'm not? Were you troubled by that?
The first person that I spoke to about this idea of what I wanted to do was my daughter, and I said to her, I'm thinking I'd like to do a whole year for solitary retreat. And what she said to me was so significant, it represents her. She thought for a minute, and she said, you could do that, Mom. You could do it. There wasn't one word about, but what about me? Not one word about what about me? Am I going to be okay? Or she just said, you can do it. I imagine it's how she was raised to be as independent as I am and to always have the confidence that I'm there for her, even if I'm not in the next room. And that's the way I raised my two, knowing that if I was going to have children, that's what they were going to have to be, for sure. So I think that's the setup. And then I talked to colleagues at MassArt, and they said, we're just afraid you're never going to come back again. So I had to show up for them, for sure. There was two things I wanted to mention to you. I have a list here. I spent a lot of time listening at silence and deciding what it looked like, what it sounded like, what it was. Silence is only there when it bangs up against other things, is what I found. But I wrote this, to listen to the silence, to compare the morning silence, so thin and expectant, to the nighttime silence, so thick and rich, dense as a good chocolate cake. To listen, to learn equanimity, this is something to which I aspire. And then I wrote the next morning, the opportunity to just sit in the forest, to be with all this verdant nature, to watch it grow and transform daily. That leaf I fell in love with 10 months ago at the turning spot of my walking meditation is still there. The insect poles have enlarged and joined together. They flute the top edge. The once glossy deep green surface has dulled, and grayish-yellow spots have appeared in three places. It is no longer the dazzling fresh growth it once was. It looks like me after a year. But it speaks of endurance and holds a strength, a presence. Soon it will lose its tenacity, its lifeblood, and will drop and become leaf litter, returning to the earth from which it grow, as I will. I watch it. I learn and appreciate. We talk about who are my teachers going to be. Goodness gracious, to have this shiny green leaf be a teacher. Kind of amazing that that would happen. The very last thing I wrote, which may tell you what on earth I got from doing all this, I'll share with you. You always want this wonderful epiphany. To let go, be purged, purified, washed by the night rain, seen through by the full moon, to be liberated, freed, let loose from all the samsaric bonds of suffering, to see with fresh eyes, to be aware of the deep silence that supports us, to return to source, drink there, be renewed, and step out again. To let that compassionate heart flow and spill over. All these things I have learned over 12 months. And at the very end, I wrote about coming back into New Hampshire. From New Zealand, I flew up to Bali, which is a similar time zone, and stayed there for 2 weeks. Some of the problem of coming out of a solitary retreat is the return. You're blasted. It's all in your face with all the demands. Suddenly you are so sensitized to... You realize what you put up with every single day, and it's no wonder you're stressed. So I went to Bali to learn how to use the telephone and how to connect with the computer and how to talk. I lost my voice 3 times the first week. I arrived in Bali en route to the U.S. and stayed for 2 weeks to get my water wings. I remained quiet and separated, peaceful. But then, as I prepared to board the plane for the 33-hour return flight, from Denpasar to Doha, Qatar, to Philadelphia, to Manchester, New Hampshire, the airport shut down for 22 hours because of volcanic ash from an eruption in East Java. I looked at those long lines of unhappy people, crying babies, angry parents, disappointed honeymooners, and my heart blew wide open. I truly loved them all. I began talking, helping, laughing at it all, making myself at home with them on the floor, doing what I could and loving it. People offered me iPhones and urged me to call my daughter about the delay. I didn't know how to use an iPhone. They found vegetarian food trays for the 4-hour stand in line. They insisted I step in front of them and go first. I just glowed and loved them. Humanity. All that I had not seen or heard for a year. I came home always remembering that woman who whispered in my ear as I boarded a plane a year ago, who said, "Thank you for doing this for me." And so I share and comfort and encourage others, even if it means just standing by and witnessing. I slipped into New Hampshire with the words of the Zen poet Shutaku on my lips. Mind set free in the Buddha's realm. I sit in the moon-filled window, watching the mountain with my ears, hearing the stream with my eyes. Each molecule preaches perfect law. Each moment chants a true sutra. The most fleeting thought is timeless. A single hair is enough to stir the sea. Thank you. In late August, early September, I had a man going crazy in the next hut and screaming in the night. He was having a psychotic breakdown. Yeah. So I spent 2 days writing down what I was afraid of. And I decided it was just okay that I was going to persevere through this. I just sent him lots of loving kindness. He managed to get the help that he needed, and I was okay. People asked me if I was lonely, and I remember I was lonely one Thursday afternoon between 1 o'clock and 1:20. I'm serious. I wrote it. It was Thursday. Right, because I realized loneliness, alone, being alone is different from loneliness. That's an emotion we manifest. And I kept saying, you asked for this. You asked for this. So,
when you speak of connections made during this year of silence, would you say you became more connected to yourself or to nature or to food or to everything? And I'm thinking that, you know, when somebody loses one of their five senses, they say that the other senses are, you know, greater magnitude. So I'm curious to see by choosing not to speak, was there a higher sensitivity in other respects? And if so, what?
I think you heard that a little bit near the end. I just fell in love with human beings. I've had lots of birds. They don't smile back at you. But a human being, you smile and they respond to you. And I came out just absolutely glowing. 33-hour flight. It was the best flight I ever had in my life. I was just like, whoa, people. And just appreciating and having such empathy for the struggles we go through, which we don't even notice. The conditions we create that we don't pay attention to that makes it difficult for us to move through. You know, all of our fears and our unhappiness and how much we create that ourselves. It was almost like being taken out of here and put over there to watch the human race in some way. That's a very, very special opportunity to have that happen. And by the way, there are many people that helped me be able to have this happen, so... Yes, go ahead, in the back. Speak very loudly for me.
Do you think that you could have done this without the foundation of Buddhism and really being prepared in the practice of it?
Usually, if there's a young person in the audience, I make a real specific thing, and I say, by the way, you know, I had 35 years of meditation before I went off and did this. I had a lot of practices. I had 10 solitary retreats before I did this. That first you start with a silent retreat with others, and then you might have a week solitary, but you certainly do build up to it. And what helped me was having one of my early solitary retreats was on a Theravadin monastery in Thailand, and I could hear the schedule from 4 in the morning until 9 at night with their bells, and I followed their schedule. And that really helped me to have kind of an idea of, I just didn't go in and just sit there and wait for something to happen. I had a regular schedule. I would say every 10 days that I'd say, okay, no schedule today. Inside of 2 hours, I was back following my schedule. So that really helped me for sure. Yes.
What do you hope to gain from your 3 years coming up?
Yeah, you're the first group to know I'm doing 3 years, by the way. I just decided 2 months ago that this 1 year solitary starting next month was going to be 3 years. And then I've been scampering since I've been back from Mexico, trying to set this up. Somebody named Matthew Ricard, who is a French biologist, a Tibetan Buddhist monk now of 40 years, said, with a solitary retreat, you're given a spade. You turn over earth. With the year solitary, you dig a hole. With the 3 year solitary, you might hit water. That's all I had to hear. And the fact that the concussion symptoms had gone, and I said, if not now, when? I should wait until I'm 80? Yeah. This year. Yeah, go for it.
Can you speak of your sensation of time? For instance, when you're working, you have a set schedule. When you're on vacation, sometimes you lose track of days. When you're on this year-long retreat, tell me about your sensation of time in terms of understanding that does it matter? Are you cognizant of time and, time of day, time of year?
Most definitely. I mean, I tried to put my clock away, and yet I had this done thermometer, and I could tell you what temperature was in Celsius and Fahrenheit at any moment during the day. And I recorded it. I wrote down the weather for every day. It was funny what I recorded and put down what seemed to be important. And I didn't let time just completely go away. I was really quite present. I'm an artist. I've worked, but I don't have a 9-to-5 job. I teach. And so having a schedule was not repulsive to me. For some of you, you might say, no way do I want that. But it wasn't. It helped me. It was like a framework to hang my day on. So, and it was flexible. Nobody was keeping track. Right. I wanted to mention what I was carrying in here. I'm a researcher. I checked about every person that had ever done a solitary retreat. And I read their book. And there aren't that many. There are only two in my order that have done anything about that. Certainly Henry David Thoreau. Admiral Richard Byrds alone is on this. A Journal of Solitude, May Sarton, is on this. Cave in the Snow, which is Tenzin Palmo, who wrote a wonderful recommendation for my book, by the way. Along with that, Melaripa, 8th century Tibetan, who went to the cave. So inspiring. He lived on nettles and he turned green. So I hate to mention it, but I had sesame seed bagels with cream cheese. Solitude, Robert Cohen, who went down to Patagonia for a year to do his PhD. He and I correspond and do Skype calls all the time. He's up in Canada. The Desert Fathers and Mothers from the Christian heritage, 3rd century in Egypt. Great. And Jane Dolbitz wrote 100 Days of Solitude. She did 100 days up in Maine. And she was up at 3 every morning and 1,000 prostrations by 6. Well, I started doing some. And then I decided that she was 25 and that I was 70 and that maybe I wouldn't do 1,000. So, I forgave myself. I did what I could. Yes, question?
I'm wondering, after the calendar year was over, were you excited about this ending or, oh, I can't wait to come home, or...
The only reason I'm doing the 3 years is because the year finished and I said I'd like to stay here. Most of us do. Most of us who have done solitary retreats, we come out and we show up because I promised that I would show up and I follow through on my promises, right? And MassArt was expecting me to teach that fall. So, yes, but I knew that I really would like to do a 3 year to see what more would happen. I'm curious. This started from when I was a teenager and saw The Birdman of Alcatraz movie. And I thought, whoa, 43 years in solitary confinement. What would happen to me? What would happen if I was put into that situation? Would I still create? Where would my mind go? So from my teen years, I was wanting to do this. So you don't wait too much longer. And you organize the family so you can do it. Or you raise a family that will support you to do it. Is that what it is? I'm not sure. Again, I will mention how lucky I am. Yes, dear.
Where are you going?
So I came back from Mexico, and I had a one-year solitary in Kentucky lined up. I'm having troubles with visas doing them other places outside of the country. But the place, which is Cedars of Peace, the Sisters of Loreto took me in, the Catholic Sisters. But they could only take me for a year. So then I began very quickly to try to find someplace else. And just 3 weeks ago, flew out to St. Louis, to Missouri, to Windridge Solitude, to another group of Catholic Sisters that have hermitages there, who said, you can be here for 2 years. So I will move from Kentucky to Missouri. And Amanda is thrilled that I'm in the United States and she can send vitamins to me more easily. And it won't take 12 days for a letter one way. So I'm in the United States for the next 3 years. I have a website and it's my name, kirinada.com. And you can go there and you can see pictures of where I'm going to be and I describe it. And if you don't pick up one of these books, you can buy one of those books online. And if you'd like to connect with me in some way by donating a meal for me, I'll remember you on that day. So, did you ask about illness? When I was planning on going in, people asked me all these questions. I said, keep asking me. You know, what about your dental? What about this? I said, because maybe I don't think of these things. I have had my teeth fixed and I have a new bridge in. And what about illness? I had read about what the Tibetans said, if you're sick, you're sick. And if you die, you die. And I want you to know that I went down to New Zealand with the intention of staying in for a year. It didn't matter what happened. I wasn't coming out. I wasn't seeing a doctor. I wasn't coming out. Amanda said, but what if you fall off the trail, you know, and you break your ankle like you've done 5 times, Mom. And I said, well, you know me, I'm tenacious. I'll crawl on my hands. I've dealt with it before. I know about broken ankles. On my hands and knees. She said, but what if you can't crawl? And do I dare say this? I said, don't worry, I'll just stay there and rot. And Amanda said to me, Mom, I don't want you to rot. So then I knew, okay, you know, reassure. So, you know, I go in good health. I know how to take care of myself. I had a dictionary. I researched lice on the dictionary to decide if that's what was giving me trouble, etc. And I just manage. It's 5 years beyond that. I'm that much older, but still, I'm in a much safer place with a lot of community around me. All those Catholic sisters who, believe it or not, come to me and say, we have a lot to learn from you. Wow. It's amazing. So I'm looking forward. I will give a talk on the 15th of July to the Sisters of Loretto down in Newark, Kentucky, about this, so that they know what I'm doing in that hut over there, and they can send good energy, which is what sustains me tremendously. I tell people that the ether is very thin when you're in silence. There's no distractions. There's no other sounds, etc. So when you are thinking of me, I get it. I know it. People think I was alone in that hut. It was so full of people. I can't tell you. They were hanging off the rafters, the people. So when you think of me, it connects through. There's a card. A friend in New Mexico made this card. She said, this is refrigerator art for your friends to put in the refrigerator. So every time they open the refrigerator, they'll think of you. I said, thank you. So there's you can take one of those home.
Fantasies, hopes, or dreams for what this 3-year retreat might do for you?
I don't. I'm open to whatever it gives me. I go in without goals, which is important. That's what I learned from the Soto Zen people. But, you know, if you don't make the attempt, you're not going to hit water. Maybe my feet will be wet when I come back. Thank you very much.